is in connection to Science Night. Please stand by.
Welcome back to another edition of the Science Night podcast. My name, well, it's James. And with me, as always, is Jason.
Hey.
Steffi is on assignment, so she's not able to join us today. But we got a special guest filling that third seat. His traps are made of physics, and his voice, well, that is pure gold. Welcome back, Matt Sowers.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Tonight, we're looking at some polluted pollinators. And in the second half, we're talking about the great geoengineering debate. We got a lot to cover, so let's get into it. Before we talk about some science, Matt's back, and it's been a while. So what do you got going on new, buddy? Got some new engineering that you're engineering, or anything fun going on in the Sowers household?
Yeah. I am, at least for work, doing my best to make small things smaller. So the typical fields of things around mechanical engineering, the new stuff, really hasn't changed in its physics since the time of Newton, but the material science changes daily. So it's anything from trying to use new plastic materials, for example, to encapsulate electronics. So a lot of the work that I do is taking hunks of functioning electronics and figuring out how to put a hunk of plastic around it so that people can't destroy it and they can use their medical device.
That sounds like a good thing. People being able to use their medical devices without them being destroyed regularly seems like net benefit, I would say.
It's hard and it's tough for the environment because it is my favorite part of engineering. It has the most sort of human interface to it, right? When you study engineering, especially in school, a lot of people take it, especially those of us with neurodivergent sort of personalities, so that we can avoid people, because the whole people avoidance thing is like a mass appeal to sticking your nose into physics and calculus, because as it turns out, there's not a whole ton of people in a very long line trying to learn that sort of thing. So you get to avoid people. The problem is that what you're actually doing is for people. So you have to figure out that what you're doing not only is for people, but if it doesn't serve people, then it's bad. Especially design engineering, it's the world of design, whether it's art design or mechanical design, still is this human creative process, but it follows the same rules as a joke. Like, if you have to explain it, then it's actually not good. Like, I hand you a hammer and you're not confused about which is the holdy end and which is the poundy end. Mm-hmm. That's good design. That's what design should be. So that's the things I'm working on now are, of course, trying to teach good design to people who are younger than me and need to learn that, which is also interesting in and of itself from the world of academia, right, where mm-hmm. I'm working now with some very, very smart people who have way more degrees than I've ever had, but with, 30-odd years worth of trying to build things wrong, I can identify what a bad thing looks like from a long way away sooner than they can. And that's just, human evolution, right? It's why our eyes are on the top of our heads rather than on our feet, is so we can see danger from a long way away. I think there's an echo to that in the world of science. Every time I look at anything that's science or engineering, all we're trying to do is see danger from a long way away, whether it's, wrecking trains on rails or, burning stuff into the atmosphere for energy or whatever. These are all things that produce problems that we need to see from a long way away. And if we're, I think we're not serving humanity very well if we're not serving that as our primary function. So I can go hide in a hole and make little bits of electronics wrapped in plastics, but unless that's doing something to make the lives of humans suck less, then we're probably doing it wrong.
You're speaking to two people here who that probably resonates with a lot, right? I mean, I'm an anatomist. James is an anatomist and a funeral director. And both of us went into professions where we were trying to avoid people and ended up having to work with people more than we ever thought we'd be working with people.
Yeah,
I'm teaching people about corporate culture at corporations, which is super awkward.
Especially if they're academics.
Right. Having some nerd talk to a bunch of PhDs about, you got to people better than this because, we're people too.
I'm sure they always take the appropriate message from your corporate culture speeches too. It's not like a skewed part that they can fit into their buzzwords or anything.
Yeah, I'm not here to sell anything. I'm just here to make it so we don't hate each other as much on a daily basis. So
it seems pretty noble to do. Right. I mean, that seems like a noble action.
That's why I live in a red state, man. I got to turn it. Turn it. I can do it from inside rather than outside. But yeah, I think people who have, I don't know, knowledge, experience, whatever, help society best when they can show people what, you know, danger looks like from a long way away or doing it wrong in front of them. And I think that's one of the reasons why humans can speak in the first place, is the ability to relay personal experience in such a way that you can feel like you've done the thing yourself, right? I mean, that's the magic of books, is somebody 1,000 years ago can put something in a piece of paper and I can crawl around in this person's head from a millennium ago and still hopefully learn the same lessons that are there. You know, you can read, I don't know, Art of War, you can read the Iliad, you can read, what you know, it just ancient works, and the human condition has not changed in human civilization. So apparently, whether there's 10,000 people packed in an area or 10 million people packed in an area, they got the same people problems and have done so for an incredibly long time.
What you're picking up on here actually is the really important point that our brains are uniquely wired to understand story. And that's because storytelling is ubiquitous among all extant and extinct human cultures. We know that it's a universal. Everyone does it, and it's because it's really effective. Our brains are actually wired to understand it in a way, right? So the idea that speech evolved so that we could start telling stories is a really attractive hypothesis. I don't know how much evidence there is for that, because that's a really difficult thing to test. But it certainly makes for a really impressive Just So story, and I like it, and we should support that idea, at least, knowing that, you know, testing that is a little more difficult than it sounds, but it's a really good way to sort of put ourselves in the world. And so I really like that. I really like that, those thoughts, Matt.
It reminds me of something that Margaret Mead never said about femurs.
Well, he brings up a really good point. Like, linguistics is this whole field of study about how language evolves, but the evolution speed of language is pretty hotly debated, right? It's kind of like rings in a tree. You count the rings in a tree because you know how long years are. What happens if a year was a different length 1,000 years ago and we don't have any evidence for it? Now, of course we do. That's the whole point, is using objective evidence that we know what tree rings are for and how we use them, but we can't do that for language. So you can see things in linguistic features of certain languages. My favorite example from the world of English being the great vowel shift from the time of Chaucer to the time of Shakespeare. So in like 200 and some odd years, you suddenly have people sounding like, you know, Juan Rapile una floreta drogta, to people sounding much more like, you know, cowards die many times before their deaths, right? I mean, that's a pretty remarkable change in what the language might have sounded like. We can only conjecture what that is, and it's a very likely conjecture, you know, because we can count the tree rings, but we still don't know how long older languages that don't have written forms go. So back to Jason's point, I mean, talking about storytelling, how do I map a cave painting to a specific story that is recorded in a third alternate media from an independent source? So I enjoy scientific rigor. The problem is there's a lot of crap we can't prove right now.
That's right. Well, yeah. That's actually a really important point also, and that is that science doesn't prove anything. It only disproves.
Here's the little tiny corner that we can assert. Yeah.
Right, exactly. Like, that is the wrong question to ask. The right question to ask is, can we find evidence that would refute it, right? And if we can't, we need to keep looking for that evidence. That's why science is such an effective tool, right? Because it is a constant series of test and retest and retest and retest, right? That's how hypotheses become theories. That's how theories become laws, right? These are really important steps in the scientific process, and it's a fundamental misconception about how it works, right? We don't prove anything. We can only disprove. So let's find the things we think we need to disprove, and let's do it. It's a different way of thinking about the world, right? And it's actually different than the way engineers think, right? Because engineers don't think that way. To me, that's what actually makes this intersection between science and engineering, because they are two different things. Even though they overlap, that's not a complete circle overlap in the Venn diagram, right? That's what makes it so interesting to have these collaborations between bench scientists and engineers, because you can start to think about things in a way that is very much more creative than a scientist can think, but it can solve the science questions, right? Those science problems using the scientific method. It's a really cool sort of thing. Anyway, all of that is to say, thanks for coming back, Matt. It's really great to see you.
I also feel like I need to point out what Matt did in like one little bit of a sentence, where he went from the evolution of human speech to knowledge and culture transmission with the evolution of language, and then analyzing cave paintings. If only we could actually get all four posts of anthropology to work that well together in real life. Mm. Gee. We would probably know a whole lot more about ourselves.
Well, so that's an interesting point, right? I spent a long time in a four-field anthropology department. Now, for those of our listeners who don't know much about anthropology, which is probably not that many, since James and I talk about anthropology quite a bit.
Never shut up about it.
Just the refresher, you know, it's a four subfield discipline. So there are four parts of anthropology all trying to solve the questions about what it means to be human. There's linguistics, there's cultural anthropology, there's archaeology, and there's biological anthropology. James and I are trained in the biological realm, but we've had to take coursework in all of the others, right? And the reason I left anthropology was because I couldn't have conversations about the work that I did with fossils with the other grad students in anthropology when I was a master's student, right? The linguistic students had no idea what I was talking about. I had no idea what they were talking about. And frankly, it felt like we were studying such different species that it was just not the place for me. I realized my questions are really rooted in anatomy, which is why I fit better in an anatomy department to answer those kinds of questions, right? And suddenly I'm in a place now where I'm the only one studying primates, or one of the few people studying primates. Everybody else is studying some other species, but I have way more to talk to them about, you know, research-wise, than I did with the folks who were, you know, digging up artifacts at a cultural heritage site, or reviving a dead language, which are really important parts of cultural understanding. So it's not to denigrate that at all. It's just that we didn't have anything to talk about. You said you lived in a red state. I live in the same red state. How's it working for you to fix it from the inside out? Because from my perch, it doesn't look like it's working very well, and I need someone to lift my spirits.
Well, so first and foremost, and not to insult anyone or any of the listeners, but it's fascinating to hear from people, especially who are in the field of biology, to also not always recognize that there is only one game that humanity is playing, and the only way to punch your ticket is to make more of you. So the propagation of the species is key. So I live here in Indiana, and I had kids, and I'm raising them in Indiana to see all the things that I have, because this is not a problem I have to solve. So I really like the concept of planting a tree under whose shade I will never sit. And that, to me, is more important. And I have friends who are my age and older who have never had kids, and they look at humanity as a whole and they're like, oh, we're doomed. You know, I can't wait for a meteor to come take our planet out. You know, things like that. Well, you know, looking for yet another cataclysmic mass extinction event. Like that's on their calendar, right? That's their idea. But for me, I have nothing other than the greatest amount of hope and forward looking into the future because of the fact that I had kids. And the reason is because I can see their ability and willingness to see things in a way that I was not only unable to, but also unwilling to. So when we look at the two components of how social advancement goes, especially with regards to science, the social change always happens faster than any other changes, right? Cultural changes happen at the speed of ideas, which is TikTok or, you know, I don't know, the internet as a whole, and the transmission tools that we have now are much greater than they ever were, right? So back in the day, press would have been controlled by people. Well, it still is controlled by people today, but now I can get a TikTok from somebody in Azerbaijan that I couldn't have gotten, you know, just 10 years ago, even 20 years ago, 30 years ago, I would not have even been able to find it on a map. So the idea that that it's getting better is great. That's what keeps driving me. And I think, especially for engineering and possibly for science, that you need a sense of hope for the work that you're doing. And philosophers aren't really good at supplying that sort of thing, right? They're more like, oh yeah, are we here or not? I'm like, bro, I'm just going with what I can, my five senses. So if I'm in the matrix somewhere and you've plugged me in and I don't know, then I don't care. It doesn't change how I behave because it's who I am as a person. So me choosing to be the way I am is me demonstrating to the rest of society that this is the way to be. That, Jason, is how I have effect. It's because I can bring this along with me, and I am pretty damn hard to ignore. So yeah, I'm going to take the privilege I have as an old white dude and throw that out on the table, not just to make the lives of other people suck less, but also to drag people sort of kicking and screaming against their own sense of dread and fear and darkness of the future, and demonstrate that there isn't a future that we don't have that doesn't include us. So we might as well make it the one we want it to be.
You going to run for office?
Dear gods. Well, see, that's the thing. People, all I got is facts and science, and nobody likes facts and science.
That's true. You actually touched on something that brings us back to anthropology a little bit. It reminded me of my favorite stuff that I learned in anthropology that wasn't fossil related, and that was cultural evolution and the mechanisms for that, right? And so I read this book as a grad student. It was written in 1976 by Richard Dawkins called The Selfish Gene, and it changed the way I thought about biology. But it really wasn't so much about the gene that really caught my attention, but another term that he coined to represent the unit of cultural transmission in evolution, the same way that a gene would represent biological transmission of a trait, right? And that term that he coined was meme.
Oh, yeah.
And now everybody knows what a meme is. But the idea was that that's how culture changes, right? So you said ideas spread like wildfire. Absolutely. The fundamental difference here between biology and cultural in terms of evolution here is that, first of all, evolution is defined as a biological concept. But if we can extend it, right, it's defined as a change in gene frequency or allele frequencies over time in a population. That's how you define biological evolution. That's natural selection is one of the mechanisms that leads to that, right? But in genetics, right, in biology, you only have vertical transmission of those traits, or I should say 90% of the time you have vertical transmission of those traits. If we talk about species that can reproduce asexually or some other way, then you can have what we call horizontal transmission or lateral transmission. But cultural evolution doesn't work only in a vertical way. It actually works more quickly in a horizontal way, right? So like you can teach your children how to whittle a piece of wood down into a spear. But you can also teach everyone surrounding you living contemporaneously and maybe the next door neighbors, right? And then the town down the road and so on and so forth. And that can spread like wildfire. That to me was one of the most interesting ideas that again is really hard to test, right? Hypotheses are really hard to test in that regard because we're talking about something that is more abstract than anything else. Blew my mind. I loved that aspect of anthropology, and unfortunately, we couldn't have the kinds of conversations with the non-biologically oriented folks over this particular aspect of cultural transmission, even though they were experts in cultural transmission, right? And it was really frustrating to me.
When you look at social evolution, it's always around its how it views itself. So there's a lot to be said for all of our artists and friends out there who help interpret what the hell's going on, right? I mean, journalists are just modern historians that are telling you what happened yesterday. That's a really important thing, is that there's somebody out there who's taking the time as a human to sort of parse this for me. And speaking as an engineer, I can tell you that I learn enough science to only, you know, get to the point where I can use the tool. As soon as I can use the tool, I'm trying to do something with it. So for me, science ends up being, I learn just enough to get to the point where I can do a thing, and then I do something with it and move on. That mimics, you know, what we see in natural behavior, especially in primates, where they pick up a stick, use it as the tool, and then when they're done, they're discarded. So, mm-hmm. You know, I kind of view engineers as sort of the apes of the scientific community because we're, you know, relentless at picking up sticks and trying things. And, you know, that's for Wheeler Woe. Energy production, obviously, one of our topics we're moving towards today, talking about CO2 emissions and things like that having an impact on some creatures out there. I mean, just the human drive to do this thing is to drive. It's like, hey, that's cool, yeah. Bro, but did you know we're burning dinosaur juice along the way and there's a penalty for that? And that's really, I think engineering and science are the fields that demonstrate most the mad scientist principle of just because you could doesn't mean you should. And this is ultimately where our friends in anthropology are trying to get us to listen to these philosophers. I'm like, I'm not a nihilist here. I'm not here to wipe everybody out. And that's the real advantage of having these kids, is seeing I can bend the future by learning the little bits of science I know to push reality along the way. And that's the tool I can use is for social promotion.
So you said something that like struck a chord with me, and that was that you know just enough science to be dangerous.
Right? Yeah.
Or you alluded to that. When I was a grad student in anthropology, we actually had t-shirts that said Anthropology Student Association, dangerously close to science.
Right. Yeah.
and the people that it upset the most were the ones who were furthest away from hard science and firmly embedded in the social science realm, right? They got offended by it, by this t-shirt, not the folks who were doing harder sciences, right? Who just thought that was hilarious.
The thing that resonated with me was this dinosaur juice mm-hmm. and burning it and the costs it has on the planet. So let's talk about our first story. If an evening primrose was covered in car exhaust, would it still smell as sweet? That is the question a team from the University of Washington set out to answer. And you'll be shocked to find out that no, it will not. In fact, the compounds in car exhaust will actually neutralize the scent molecules of flowers. But it goes farther than missing out on a pleasant scent to accompany your stroll through the garden. Turns out that pollinators will have trouble finding flowers. Under experimental conditions, hawk moths were 70% less likely to be attracted, which led to a decrease in the productivity of the primrose plant. So it looks like the highway to the danger zone is running right through our flower gardens of evening primroses and hawk moths. So what do we think about these reduction of scent created by burning dinosaur juice and covering our primroses with smog?
Well, if there was another reason not to do it, here it is. This is one thing that has a dramatic effect on our ability to sustain life on the planet and continue to feed our species, right? And we're messing that up too. But the long-lasting effects of this are not as easily seen. You don't see the effect of this like you see changes in weather and therefore changes in climate the same way. And so I think that it's horrifying and completely expected. There is a cost to burning all this dinosaur juice, which, by the way, is a terrible phrase that I will always use from now on, and I love it.
I love that it's alarming, by the way, growing up knowing. So there was a company called Sinclair Oil.
Yeah.
And there was a TV show called The Dinosaurs, and the name of the family in there was the Sinclairs.
Earl Sinclair. That's right.
That's right.
That it just cracks me up. I was like, these people get it. I'm watching the show. Even if it's dinosaur puppets, I'm watching it anyway.
We should get that show back. We should get it going again. Where's a Kickstarter for that?
I took my youngest to his first Kansas City Chiefs game in Kansas City last October. And to get there, you know, from Indiana, we had to drive through the state of Missouri, right? And so we stopped in Columbia, Missouri, which is the home of the University of Missouri, my alma mater. And there is still a Sinclair gas station in Columbia, Missouri, but there are very few of them around the country left. It's still there, though.
Do they still use the dinosaur?
They do. Logo? The dinosaur logo is still there.
I love it.
Yeah. So this is why I still use the term dinosaur juice, is because it's what it is. It's pressed dinosaur juice. We probably shouldn't be blowing, you know, hydrocarbons into the atmosphere in a combusted state, but we could talk about that in a minute.
So here's the thing that I think we should like point out as we're talking about this story, as opposed to what we're going to talk about in the second half, is this is showing the effects of CO2, car exhaust specifically, on the world, right? And it is paid for by a university that is just showing you what happens when this happens. We're going to talk about something called geoengineering in the second half, which is getting pushed by far different power factors. So I think that's something to keep in mind, is we're just showing you what happens here. This is science showing you what happens, And we're looking at the evidence and we're finding that when pollinators can't pollinate, boy, that's not a good thing.
Again, there's some folks out there who are looking for another mass extinction event. If all we have to do is nothing.
Yeah. Did anyone else think of the peppered moth when they were reading this? Did that pop into anyone's mind, or is my
what is a peppered moth
broken?
This is a great story actually, because it's a story that takes us back to the Industrial Revolution. James, go.
The year was 18 something in England. The Industrial Revolution was really popping off, and before the Industrial Revolution, there was something called a peppered moth. And it looks probably like you're expecting it to. It was a white, mostly white moth with black specks on it. Look like pepper was on its torso and head. But here's the thing about the Industrial Revolution, specifically in England at its heyday. They were just throwing coal into the air.
Yeah.
Coal everywhere. Turns out that these moths adapted like you would expect them to, and they became darker and darker and darker. And now that's kind of like the default state for the peppered moth. It is now black with specks of white in response to pollution, because they were able to kind of stay hidden in this overall city landscape that they found themselves in. So
yeah, they could better camouflage onto the trees that were soot covered if they were darker. Yeah, so they were less likely to be picked off as prey. And it's an amazing story, right? I just don't understand why they're not now called the salted moths.
I mean, let's get that going, too. We got $2 million ideas out of this episode, is rebooting the dinosaurs franchise and changing the name of the peppered moth to the salted moth. But that was definitely what I thought about is, hey, I know I never say this quote on this show, but, you know, sometimes nature finds a way.
True, but here's the difference. In the case of the peppered moth, changes in gene frequencies occurred, presumably because moths that were darker were able to be camouflaged better, and so therefore they didn't get eaten as quickly, and they were able to reproduce more effectively. But they weren't having problems eating.
That's true.
We're now talking about pollution that is making it impossible for pollinators to find their pollen sources. And that is not just about the survival of that species, but it's the survival of its symbiote. And I'm not talking about venom. When I'm talking about a symbiote in that way, I'm talking about, you know, the fact that whatever it is that these moths are pollinating, primrose in this case, they are symbiotic. They rely on each other to continue the propagation of those species. That is dramatically more alarming. I guess what I'm trying to say is we look at the peppered moth as a really cool, uplifting story about how nature can survive. And then we look at this current story, right, with these hawk moths, and we're like, well, this is a way that nature is not going to survive. And this is really scary.
So the message is now nature can survive to a point.
There's a degree of adaptation that things can handle. And I don't know what that is, but looking from the outside, hey, species changing colors due to exposed sunlight, for example, humans, is pretty obvious on the planet, because you can find darker skinned humans in areas where more natural light occurs. So that's just an easy kind of thing to map in an Occam's razor to use and so on and so forth. But what it doesn't tell us is that some stuff is easier to change. Like, I can't wake up tomorrow and have a bowl of petroleum jelly and get nutrition out of that. So why not? You know, what's the difference between adaptation, you know, evolution, which genes are easier, you know? So it seems to be easier to change one's physical appearances, but for me to suddenly digest rock is maybe a larger evolutionary step. And
right,
we have the ability to do things to our environment and have done so for all of humanity. So whether that is changing the course of a river, whether that's selective hunting, which of course is what happened here in the Americas before it was colonized, you know, all of these things, these concepts of a Garden of Eden that is documented in, you know, ancient texts isn't anything more than what humans sort of passively genetically engineered. I think the term is animal husbandry, but it's not like you find cattle in the wild. There's no wild cow. There's no wild chicken. You know, these are only things that humans have domesticated up to a point where they're no longer resembling the species they came from. And that took a long, long, long time. I love the examples of the brassicolas around the planet, where you've got, you know, cauliflower here and broccoli there, and then this one's, you know, spinach temperature or whatever, and it has to do with the soil and how you favored this particular grass and how this mustard, you know, collard greens or mustard greens just turned into something else depending on either where you're at or which ones you liked picking more. So humans have always been doing this. And there's the stuff that we can do by just sort of altering the environment to change whether we get white asparagus or not. You know, that's just changing its growing conditions. You don't have magic asparagus or anything like that, right? You just change its growing conditions. Okay, what happens if we change the growing conditions of everything? We are in a lust on this planet for the energy that we can produce that helps us have these conveniences, but I'm going to poke at our dude bros on the planet, as well as the ones I'm descended from, that specifically look at the capacity for our planet to sort of, you know, stabilize. And that stability is an assumed neutral point, kind of like putting a marble into a bowl. It's going to settle down at a specific point. Well, there is a point where you can knock the bowl over and knock the marble out of the bowl. And you're done. That's it. There's no more game to play. And I don't like to play the game of how far can we push it before we all die. This feels like one of those things that we can push it when we all die. This is the same idea. If I were to roll it back to the previous session that we were talking about, the ecological disasters around the Cuyahoga and, you know, plaguing Eastern Ohio and have done for a century, because as it turns out, capitalism hasn't changed in its lust for money any more than anyone has changed their lust for random free energy. And the thing is that humans don't actually want this. Like, you walk up to somebody who's like, how many megajoules do you want to consume today? And they'll go, what are you even talking about? What's a joule? You know, and why are they so big? You know,
but if I'm going to consume a joule, I definitely want it to be supersized, right?
That's right. Exactly. Cause this is America. Sorry. So, but, nobody really thinks of it that way, right? So how do you allow people to do the things that are useful for humanity that make us better as people while trying to not expose us to the things that actively destroy the environment? And that's right up there with, I'm the professional here. I don't expect you to know how to design a seatbelt. I'm the dude who does that for you. So maybe I should also put something in your car. For example, and this is new in my lifetime, the catalytic converter, right? So this was the first attempt at, oh my God, we really are putting out a lot of noxious emissions here, and that's bad. You want to talk about your moth changing from a peppered moth to a salted moth, I guess. I can remember in my lifetime visiting places like Manhattan and seeing this yellow fog around the city as we drove in and being alarmed by that as a child, going, what the hell is this? And they're like, oh, that's smog. And I was like, well, what's smog? So if you go and type in the word smog into Wikipedia, you're going to get a number of fascinating articles over the last 150 years of places in the United States that people died or were sickened in the tens of thousands because of the exposure to smog. And it's always tied with some sort of temperature inversion and, you know, the collective conditions that we burned a whole lot of coal or we burned a whole lot of gasoline or we burned a whole lot of something. And that hung in the air, and it hung in the air in just such a bad way that it was causing respiratory distress to people in the area for up to a week. It happened in, you know, what was it, New York, and I think in 59 was the most recent one where it was like 7 days long. The one I was reading about before that was one that actually just killed dozens of people in Pennsylvania, in this southwestern area of Pennsylvania, where, you know, it's, that's that buckle of the steel belt where you want to, like, you know, figure out where all the coal comes from, right? And all the slag and the runoff and all these other things for doing manufacture. So the profit then is what was driving that, and the need for production. And the need for production and profit were prized over our question of, are we saving the environment? And it sounds a whole lot like the question of, well, we just wanted to see if we could. We didn't ask if we should. So we try to come up with air scrubbers, right? And one of the most common ones is the catalytic converter that's in your car that's new since the 70s. And the idea is that you have some noble metal inside this and you're blowing your exhaust over there. So you have nitrogen monoxide, nitrogen dioxide, a number of other noxious emissions depending on, you know, how hot it gets in there. And then, of course, you've got carbon monoxide and carbon dioxide. So how do I take out the super bad stuff and have it just be the CO2 that comes out? And you can catalyze this reaction of recombination where you're oxidizing the carbon monoxide back into carbon dioxide on the surface of this platinum electrode that lives in, you know, lives in your catalytic converter. And we can do that passively to try to help our bee-like friends, but that doesn't change the total amount of CO2 being put up into the atmosphere. Right. And that's just the cars that people are driving around. And that's where all this hope comes from in the world of science, is because if I could teach my kids that public transportation is just strictly better than individual transportation in terms of energy consumption, just it doesn't matter where you get your energy from. Imagine it's a person pulling you around. There are literal billionaires today pushing a red button on their desk that gives them money for people dying. That's a thing that they do. And the average person doesn't think of it that way. And I can tell you the billionaire doesn't think of it that way. And the reason they don't think of it that way is so they can sleep at night. If you want to find out what sort of person you are, go to a place that has a rickshaw and see if you will pay another person to wheel you around. Now, there's nothing that's terrible about the effort, and these still exist, especially in areas all over Japan, where it is not, you know, most countries are not handicapped accessible. I don't really know what to tell you. And that is a true statement. That is a fault of humanity, and that's a thing we need to work on as a society, is to make things accessible for other humans. So the lack of accessibility is just built into anything that's also old. So the older something is, the more likely it is to not be accessible to all humans. So a rickshaw is a great solution for that. But when you see that it's, you know, carefully balanced wheel cart and somebody in there, doesn't really matter what they weigh due to the physics of the arrangement for this, you can drag another human about without using much effort. Having said that, are you willing to pay somebody to drag you around? Do you think that is a thing that humans should do? Or can I look at myself in the mirror and see my jowls and realize I should probably pedal my own fat ass around and, you know, get something better for myself, because the body was, you know, meant to move, as they say, right? You know, I mean, it's pretty clear through evolution that me sitting at a desk was something that is not anything evolution ever predicted for me to do, even though I'm perfectly adapted to do it. So in the engineering part of it, why don't you see 10-person rickshaws? It's because they're heavier. It's too hard to drag somebody around. So you need some other thing to do the work for you. And I think I mentioned on our the last time I was a guest here, the reason they invented, you know, things like the automated motor coach to replace things like horses is because horses were dying in the streets, you know, from transporting people around. And then what do you do with this horse carcass? So sure, a little puff of blue smoke and you know, off you go, and no more dead horses in the streets. This sounds like a great invention, this automobile. Well, and it brings all these other problems along with it, because it's not like we had catalytic converters in those automobiles for the first 100 years. So that's 100 years of people with access to the, you know, the horseless carriage without having any sort of environmental regulation. So yeah, maybe 100 years is enough for moths to change their spots, but it's definitely not enough for every species on the planet to stop needing food that comes from animals.
I think we've set up the problem. We have all this stuff in the atmosphere, and it's starting to change that climate that we talk about so much. So in the second half, we're going to maybe talk about a potential solution, maybe. But first, a message from a podcast that I think you're going to enjoy.
Hi, fancy folks. Welcome to Lux Sci, where we make science fun, approachable, and most of all, fancy. I'm Dr. Lex, former microbiologist, current global health consultant, and enthusiast of all the finer things in life. I'm often joined here by my husband, electrical engineer, inventor, and our audio engineer, Dr. Demos. In this podcast, we take listeners on a journey into the microscopic worlds of luxury items and unravel the fascinating intersection of science and opulence. From how bubbles form in champagne, to the molecular forces that harden clay in a kiln, to the amount of thrust needed to send a rocket to space. No luxurious topic is safe from our insatiable curiosity. We're on a mission to demystify science and show how it drives the world around us. No PhD or lab coat required. So if you've ever wondered how science and luxury seamlessly intertwine, join us as we uncover untold stories, hidden marvels, and the inner workings of scientific discovery and sophistication. Along the way, we'll also chat with amazing scientists and artisans. So subscribe now and let the exploration begin.
This storm hitting Mainers in multiple ways. Coastal flooding was a big concern.
Still picking up the pieces after Hurricane Nicole earlier this month and Ian earlier this year.
Dead, so we have to pull it and replace it.
Each blue ribbon
in Texas, our crew on the way to the scene, and here's Maria B. Real now.
Damaged by extremely cold temperatures back in 2020.
On this show, we talk a lot about climate change, and we're usually focusing on the effects on the planet or the effects on people's lives and how it's just changing everything. And we also talk a lot about how we can cut back on emissions. But today, we're taking a new strategy. We're going to talk about a brand new futuristic way that we can turn back the clock. It's called solar geoengineering. Geoengineering sounds like something out of sci-fi because it basically is. The idea? Put something into the atmosphere and have it reduce the effect of the sun on heating the planet, potentially turning back the clock on climate change. It's fascinating. Basically, spray something into the atmosphere and all your problems go away. Make the clouds a little bit brighter and all of a sudden, our lives get a little bit brighter too. All of our problems disappear. I'm sure there's no issues at all, and there's definitely not a dark undercurrent that includes a play for the further entrenchment of the oil industry. What's not to love?
Breaking news. Geoengineering may be a convenient way to maintain the status quo for the oil industry, shifting the narrative away from reducing emissions and wrapping future profits in a veneer of shiny futurism inspired by technology.
Huh. Who saw that coming? So here's the thing. We don't know what messing with the atmosphere will do long term. Maybe it's going to lower temperatures temporarily, but maybe it's going to cause more problems. What if it impacts the ozone layer, and it could affect weather patterns? Even things I can't comprehend, like, I don't know, overcorrecting the global temperature so that the world's trapped in an unending ice age, and the few remnants of life are trapped in a real long train that's just constantly journeying around the globe. Or, like, I don't know, the sky turns green. The point is, the root cause of climate change is emissions. Solar geoengineering is a quick, but temporary fix that allows the fossil fuel industry to become even more entrenched by turning the narrative towards technological fixes instead of emission reduction. And if you need the proof, look at who's leading the charge for solar geoengineering. As recently as February 2024, an effort to establish a UN group on solar geoengineering was led by the US, Switzerland, Monaco, Saudi Arabia, Georgia, and Israel. All countries with a large stake in the future of the fossil fuel industry in some way. All pushing for this to be legitimized at the international level. But it was blocked. And who opposed it? Unsurprisingly, the opposition came from the areas that will be hit the hardest by climate change, specifically African, Latin American, and Pacific Island nations. But it's not to say that science can't help with climate change. We just need to make sure we're focusing our efforts on the right projects. The path forward is not simple. Solar geoengineering offers a short-term solution,
But there's a significant risk that we shift the focus away from reducing emissions and embracing renewable energy. So instead, let's change the narrative a little bit. Instead of this great geoengineering debate that the oil industry is putting forward, that we cool the planet now and continue on as we are into the future, why don't we say a shortcut in the sky or a sustainable path for the future on the ground?
So in the first half, we talked about there's just CO2 all over the place. You can't swing a dead hawk moth without hitting too much CO2 in the atmosphere. And now we have this like geoengineering thing where we can shoot more stuff into the atmosphere, and that's just fine. I'm sure that'll work out just fine. But the thought is, if we can deflect some of the sun's rays, maybe the Earth gets a little bit cooler. What do we think about geoengineering?
I don't want to turn the Earth into Venus.
That would be suboptimal, as they say in the engineering world, right?
Right. Yeah. So I think our options with that are we turn the Earth into Venus or we turn it into Mars. And it looks like it's going to do that all by itself, and all it needs to do is wait. So all we can do is really hasten that process along. Right, if a pendulum can only swing two ways, there's not a third way it can swing.
I agree with you. I think I would like to emphasize that big oil is why we're in this problem to begin with. So maybe we shouldn't rely on big oil's solutions that uses more of big oil's product to try to solve the problem big oil caused. Because, again, we don't want to be Venus. We don't want to be Mars. Right? We don't want to be anything but maybe Earth 100 years ago, right? So let's try to get there.
Back when the pepper moths were white and sprinkled with little black spots, right?
That's right.
That should be the new bellwether. We just keep, it's moth watch. we gotta see what the moths are doing.
We don't have ads on TV or, you know, that are like the old radio ads of 4 out of 5 doctors smoke camel. The supply side economics in society that drives these things is killing that view. And that's the dissenting voice that gets us moving sort of in the wrong direction. Anything that looks like if you spent your way into this problem, you can spend your way out, is definitely not driven by science. It's probably driven by economics. And that's how you can tell. And it's just a louder voice that you can hear every day if you consume any sort of medium. So if you stay away from all media, which you should not, you should definitely listen to podcasts, the message is out there of 4 out of 5 doctors smoke camel, you know, or we've been burning coal and gasoline for so long that we're going to figure out a new way for that to be good. You know, it's just not, right? It can't be. So we have to undo it somehow. And what's cool is we actually have evidence that we can do this. So in my lifetime, I remember as a child that chlorofluorocarbons were used in literally every sort of propellant, whether it was Aquanet hairspray, which, by the way, is fantastic if you've got a lighter at taking, you know, rid of wasps. Sorry, there's I'm sure there's some evolutionary purpose of wasps, but I hate them.
They hate you, too.
Good. Glad to hear it.
As it turns out, we had a conversation a few weeks ago. Yeah.
Good. Good. I hope they remember me. So, but anyway, we don't need to your point, there's no way that we're going to spend our way back out of a problem in the same, you know, with the same group of people who got us into the problem. So the reducing of that is the reducing of CFCs in my lifetime actually kind of healed the hole in the ozone layer. We used science to predict a very bad thing was going to happen. We had objective evidence to see it. And then we're like, hey, y'all, can we lay off the CFCs? And the consumer didn't care. The average end user was like, I don't even know what that is. And for, you know, our ability to actually regulate industry, because that's 70% plus of the pollution on the planet in the first place, that is absolutely who you need to regulate to cause these things to go away. So we just made it illegal to use CFCs and to make them and to fabricate them and to store them. And if you do everything along the way where you just can't have CFCs anywhere, suddenly it becomes ridiculously expensive to do the thing the wrong way. So we can use these artificial tools in society to create artificial barriers for doing the bad thing. So we can make there be some sort of penalty that the people who are buying and selling can get. And I think that's effective. And we've demonstrated it's effective. So then we do the same thing with regulations in the United States, right? We have LEV, ULEV, other requirements for vehicle fuel efficiency. And we have more than one case in the last 10 years of automotive companies who've been cheating on the test. It's not just that they put the car in a test mode, it's that they literally have the software change what the firmware can see so that it thinks it's passing a test it's not actually passing. Mm-hmm. Again, that's doing it the wrong way. So there has to be a penalty for that. And if the penalty is just more money, then all they're doing is transferring the cost for doing it the wrong way to the consumer. So there has to be a different knob we can turn. And CFCs were turned by a knob of a bunch of kids like me who grew up watching Sesame Street and, you know, The Muppet Show or whatever, and listening to the environmental concerns that were brought up there and being taught in school that the environment is a thing. I had classes on ecology, and I was in fourth grade in Pennsylvania, one of the, you know, most offensive states in terms of natural disasters created by humans.
Yeah, you know, we got a string of them in the Keystone State. But hey, but Rocky was fun. That was a good
one. Right.
And to your point about CFCs, right? Sometimes removing something that we know is harmful actually has multiple added benefits, right? So in addition to stopping the growing size of the hole in the ozone layer, I don't know that we necessarily healed it, right? But we certainly prevented the degradation at the rate that it was happening. But it also got rid of mall bags, right? So win-win. No more Aquanet.
Sure.
No more growing hole in the ozone layer.
And it turns out had plenty of other propellants to put in cans. It turns out that, you know, we didn't need to use CFCs in like all kinds of refrigerators, right? We can come up with other refrigerants. Yeah, baby, I miss Freon. As a mechanical engineer, the delta T you get out of compressing that substance and having it do a phase change, I really miss that. But you know what? I'd rather use the other thing that's not going to kill us all.
But, you know, to your point, we also have plenty of ways to make energy. We have plenty of ways to make cars go. Problem is, we got oil companies with a lot of money and a lot of power. And if you're like, you're wondering, you know, how closely tied are the oil companies to this whole geoengineering scheme that we've been kind of talking about? And one of the articles that we are going to share with you here is from oilprice.com. That is a website that is so dedicated to the price of oil and the oil industry that it is right there on Front Street. It's a .com. They were in there early. So when I guess the point of all of this is when you see stories like this that seem pretty cool and pretty sci-fi, and it's going to herald in that Jetson's light future, look at where that's coming from. Look at where the sources are. Look at who's paying for this and who's benefiting for this. Because boy, are oil companies hoping we just look at the planet could get a little cooler so we can keep driving our cars on unleaded. And yeah, so just be careful out there. So I think that means we're at the end of another edition of the Science Night podcast. But don't worry, we got more coming your way soon. And hopefully we're going to have Matt come back on soon as well, because we love Matt.
Woohoo!
So if you want to follow us on social media, that's probably a good thing. You can follow me at James_Reed3. Jason, where can they follow you?
You can find me on Twitter at OregonJM. You can find Steffi on several places too. Fusion Deem.
At Steffi Deem, at Starship, and at Fusion Deem. Follow her on all those things. You know what? Since she's not here to speak for herself, we're going to add her profiles in the show notes. So you can go follow her, because let's face it, that's the reason you were here. I'm sorry she couldn't make it, but Matt was awesome. So Matt, speaking of you, where can we find you and follow you?
Well, let's see. I'll probably be at Gen Con in person this year, doing another talk on traps and that sort of thing. I don't really have like socials for that sort of thing, just for me. So
you know how you can support Matt is by blowing this episode up, and then there's going to be more Matt on this dial. If we get 1,000 day one downloads, you're going to hear a lot more Matt. So just click that download button. And you can also follow the show at Cyanide Pod. Visit our home on the web, cyanide.com, where you'll find past episodes, the people we talk to, the things we talk about. Oh, and you're also going to find our merch. Check out that merch. It's a fun page. It's just collecting dust right now because you've been away for so long. But we're here to welcome you back and allow you to buy our merch. So just go over and do that. It's at cyanide.com. You're going to have fun. We're going to be back in a few weeks with a new episode. But until then, seriously, like, I think mothwatch is the new hot thing we can do. We can have a moth and we can just have it shift as the CO2 gets higher or lower. And, you know, we want that moth.
This is going to be a real problem for me, Matt, this year, that my liver is going to be wrecked because we have Gen Con and three nights of fish at Deer Creek the same weekend.
Oh.
And that is going to be a confluence of worlds that I cannot wait to experience. But when you see me, right, just hand me a bottle of water. I'm going to need it.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. If you're at Gen Con and you see Jason, tell him to hydrate.
There you go. Thank you.